Hello, and welcome to AgTech So What, brought to you by the AgVentic Group. You've probably heard of these seemingly magical inputs that farmers are told they can put on their seeds or crops, and then suddenly the plant is heat-resistant or no longer waterlogged. Often, these are biologicals, a different type of input. And let's be honest, right now, many in the industry would call them snake oil.
People say it's a trade secret we can't tell you, but we increase pepper production by 17% and we lower your nitrogen bill by 23%. That doesn't cut it if you want to scale this business.
That's Jarrett Chambers. He's the president of ATP Nutrition, and he's all about plant nutrition, including biologicals and biostimulants. For Jarrett and his company, the science is critical for credibility in the market. In this episode, we dig into the so what of biologicals, not just biostimulants, but also products like biopesticides and biofertilizers, to understand why they've historically had such a poor rep and a poor track record of adoption. Shane Thomas, agronomist and author of Upstream Ag Insights, also joins us to look at the drivers behind biologicals and what characteristics, business models, and incentives can help ensure they fit into established farming systems. It's a complex topic, but that's never stopped us before. And on the plus side, it turns out our two Canadian guests already know each other.
I don't know if I've ever told you this, Jarrett, but I don't think you remember, but I had my first ever agronomy conference that I was at, and Jarrett was actually speaking, and I was still in university, and he presented, and he was talking about something along the lines of zinc and root growth. And so at that point, when you're a summer student, nobody gives you the time of day because you're not going to influence sales. You're not going to influence anything. I went up to Jarrett and asked him a question about zinc and if he could send me some of the slides. And he literally was like, yeah, I'll take your email. He sent me like all the entire slide deck.
That was fairly humbling, so I'm not even sure how to reply to that. So I'm not going to.
I don't know if I told you that before. You probably don't remember. It was at a grow event.
I do. Yeah, I do remember the grow events. Yes, yeah. I do remember the grow events. Yes, that's very nice, Shane.
It never ceases to amaze me how ag is such a small world. But before we get too far into biologicals, I asked Jarrett, who has a master's of science in soil fertility and microbiology, and has spent the last two decades understanding nutrition and plants, to explain what exactly we're talking about here.
So we're going to break it down into a couple pieces. Okay, so really today, the biologicals, you have your biologicals that are for pest control. So the biopesticide world. That is one main space, and that is a space where most of the uptake is in either greenhouse production, horticulture production, or field-grown high-value crops, field-grown production with 7, 8, 9, 10 applications during the year where you're just protecting that crop. That is a pretty big space for the biopesticide industry. Then there's also the biostimulatory piece of the biologicals, which is the area which falls under one of the four categories of biostimulants. So when I look at biostimulants, I look at four categories based off everything I've read. You have the biological family as one of the four main categories under the biostimulant umbrella. And again, this is not just my opinion. This is me reading what everybody else is saying. Then, of course, you have your seaweed extracts or plant extracts as one of the four families. Then you have your carbon-based products, which is like your humics and your fulvic acids as the third family. And in your fourth family are these amino acids or these protein hydrolysates. So those are the four main families. So when you look under biostimulants or bionutritionals under the biologicals, that falls under that one of the four categories as a biostimulant. Those are sort of the two main things, the biopesticide and then the biostimulant.
I think, you know, within that biostimulant side is where you would find also the inoculants side of things, where your nitrogen fixation around the legume side, but also the new products that are working to actually do it in the corns and all those other different products as well. And I think one thing that I get questions on a lot too is, you know, when we hear biostimulants and biologicals, we tend to think something that is actually living, but a biostimulant is actually based on what it does to the plant. It stimulates the plant. And Jarrett touched on the protein hydroxylates and the nitrogenous compounds, which aren't necessarily living organisms. They are something else. And so those actually do call it deliver a stimulation to that plant that is naturally occurring and makes it do something, exude or release different extracts out of the plant roots or something along those lines, call it to stimulate its systemic acquired response, which is kind of like a plant immune system. And so you get something along those lines too, which I think is worth noting on top.
the super helpful explanation. What we then talk about often in the investment world, and I imagine farmers care about this too, is sort of the mechanism, like how does it work? So is that sort of separate to what it's stimulating or the different categories you outlined? You could actually have a different mechanism, as in it uses a fungus to do this, or it targets this kind of plant response. Is that right? That the kind of mechanism is separate from the application?
Well, I'll take a first stab at it. So I think this is really the key piece for credibility for this space. Sometimes you would say in the past, I put on this biological and I increased yield. First of all, that's not the mechanism. That's not the mode of action. That's the outcome. One of the things I was taught 25 years ago when I was working down in California, which this was already being presented to us probably more than 25 years, was we made it very clear to companies that met up with us, basically, what's in your product and how does it work within the plant or the soil system? And I would say at that point, 90%+ of the people that walked through our door had no idea. On number two, they said, this is what's in our product, or they'll say it's a trade secret, we can't tell you, but we increase pepper production by 17% and we lower your nitrogen bill by 23%. That doesn't cut it if you want to scale this business. At the end of the day, that you need to figure out what's in your product. But as Shane said, is it the organism that doing it, or is the organism your production plant? Your organism is producing a collection of different peptides and metabolites. And those peptides and metabolites, they are then working within that plant. And then the mode of action with RNA sequencing work right now being economical, it can tell you what genes are being turned on, what genes are being turned off. And once we get there, and I know a lot of people say that I don't work with, because we're not aligned with these people, is the farmer or the crop input retailer doesn't want to know that. I say, no, you're wrong. You're wrong. I mean, you have to know how these products work, because I don't care to show a positive response. What I need to learn about and what farmers need to learn about is where did they not work and why did they not work there, which is the same way of saying, how do they work? So I'll get off my soapbox for a minute and let Shane correct everything I've just said.
No, I love the way you put it, Jared, and I agree 100%, because once you actually understand how it works and where it works, that's when you can really get better outcomes and you can have higher ROI and better specific outcomes for the farmers, for everybody involved. And I think about it from, say, a herbicide perspective. We understand there's herbicides, but then there's groups of herbicides, and then there's subfamilies of the herbicides, and then there's active ingredients, and then there's a specific mode of how that works and what weeds it works on and all these sorts of things. And the synthetic, call it crop or life science companies, crop input manufacturers, they put in the time to understand the science behind this in the lab. They put this time in to understand the science in the fields and where that's going to work, why it works, the percentage of control, all these sorts of things, the injury. And that's where we need to get to in the biological space to really see the confidence increase so that farmers can feel better about utilizing them. They have more confidence of where the ROI is going to come from, what that's going to look like, and agronomists don't have an apprehension to recommend them, because there's just been so many companies out there, and this is not specific to North America, this is all over the place. These fly-by-night companies come and do exactly what Jared said. They just, well, we've seen this response, so you should just put it on everything without really understanding the how and the why. And that's been something that's really given the entire segment that snake oil's name. And that's something that groups like ATP Nutrition and others are working to overcome by working with the scientists, working to understand the specifics of these products. And that's what's going to really help even the venture capital space or the biologicals get investment from a venture capitalist that actually wants to make sure that there's a product that has a fit and that has something that can be leveraged clear across field crops or even the horticulture crops as well too.
Yeah, that makes sense. Can you maybe, just to bring all of that to life before we dig into some of those business model challenges and a bit more on the snake oil as well, what's a specific example of, like, here's a product, here's how it works, and then here's what it does, just to kind of walk us through, I know there's no real simple ones there, but take one just to kind of separate out the mechanism from what actually happens in the field and what a farmer might have to understand to kind of think about this.
We'll look at a biological where it's not the organism, but it's the compounds that are come out of it. So we'll look at a real life example where took organisms, we removed the organisms, we had this collection of different metabolites. We then went to various laboratories. We figured out what's actually in these compounds at different concentrations. Then from there, we did some very simple in vitro screening, and we saw certain anatomical responses going on as a seed treatment. You get more rooting going on as a foliar spray, maybe under a salt condition, you're actually helping that plant push through the salt condition. And we did three really interesting experiments, RNA sequencing experiments. One of them was we actually put a plant under cold conditions and we put this treatment on. And what it basically did is it turned it up and down regulated a whole bunch of genes associated with cold conditions. And what it actually told the plant in the simplest sense was, you're not cold, so grow as if it's warm. And that you can say, okay, I'm not really sure if I'm there on this. And it talked about auxin responses and a free radical buildup and a whole bunch of photosynthetic pieces, which I love all this really boring science behind. But then we did a study where we actually made the plant waterlogged. Okay, and we did a different series of treatments, put it on. And then what it basically showed is it, in essence, it helped with photosynthesis, it helped it made respire, it turned off a whole bunch of genes that are normally turned on when a plant gets waterlogged. And so what it said in the simplest sense is, you are no longer waterlogged. Okay, so now we got all these different markers on what enzymes is turning on. But to me, the eureka moment was the third one, which is maybe a little bit more comparable for myself, is the plant nutrition one, where we made a plant zinc deficient. And we were doing this with the Harvest Zinc Initiative, which is one of the largest initiatives for fortification of food on the planet. The Gates Foundation is the largest producer, and a good friend of mine, Dr. Chakmak, heads up that program. And what we did for that project is we actually made the plant zinc deficient. We then put on these compounds, this biostimulant produced from these biologicals, and we sprayed onto the plant. We did all the RNA sequencing work on it, and it basically turned on seven genes that are associated with the way zinc impacts photosynthesis. So it actually told the plant, you are not zinc deficient. So turn on all of these genes that were turned off because the plant was zinc deficient, so it's shutting down. So when you look at each experiment by itself, you're like, okay, I'm there. It's really cool. Lots of great stuff. But when you put it all together, what it basically is doing from this compounds is it's telling the plant, we're here to help you respire as efficiently as possible. But if we don't give you zinc, we actually are going to kill the plant quicker. That's the confusing thing, because we're saying you're not zinc deficient, so work harder. But if we don't give you food, you've just actually died quicker, if that makes any sense. So when I look at this, and then you lay it out with your customers and you lay out the modes of action, most of them, they're already asleep by this point, but a lot of them still care. So what they really see is they see how it up and down regulates genes. It makes the plant try to respire better. And when you think about the series of experiments that were done in this compound, it is the perfect definition that the U.S. government has laid out as a definition of a biostimulant, which is about improving nutrient use efficiency. Why? Because we addressed the zinc things. Improving nutrient uptake, which we did. Dealing with abiotic stress, which is Mother Nature. We created cold stress in one. We created moisture stress in another. Another experiment, we created salt stress. It helped overcome those to ultimately drive quality and yield, which is the definition by the U.S. government. And we never talked about yield, but what we talk about is if you can have a perfectly respiring plant, which doesn't, perfection doesn't exist, but a better respiring plant, then all the food it consumes is going to be taken in better, which means the plant is healthier, which means it has the ability to ward off infection, which means when you put on a fungicide, the fungicide is going to work better because the cell structure in those leaves and those roots is stronger.
Like I said, it's complex, which is no doubt part of the reason why investment in and adoption of biologicals has been pretty slow. But there are some signs that this is changing as demand grows for environmentally friendly products and as producers are under pressure from consumers and regulators to lower chemical use. A recent report by Fior Markets says the global ag biologicals market is expected to grow from $8.5 billion US dollars in 2020 to nearly $27 billion by 2028. Jarrett says this has caught the attention of private equity firms.
I think what's happened is with the fact that agriculture is one of those frontiers that private equity companies know we got to feed the world, the 9 billion people and all of that type of stuff. I think they're going, if they look at their portfolios, they go, you know, we don't have a big ag portfolio and it's kind of important because we got to feed the world. So then the question is, you're going to go, well, what's the fastest growing space? Well, commodity fertilizers, you know, everything's got its normal modest growth, but because the biological business is small, there's nothing more than upside. And I think what happens in this is you have a lot of very intelligent people that have been there for 30 or 40 years, but nobody's ever listened to their idea. And I think with the analytical equipment that's available, people can characterize these products or these compounds or these organisms quicker. And then they show value. They can use the word sustainability. They can use the transparency. They can use the word reduce pesticide loading, reduce synthetics, application of synthetic fertilizers. So these are a lot of words that I would say the private equity group wants to hear, the consumer wants to hear. And so what happens is people get quite curious about this space.
Got it. So if I had to summarize, I would say, and this makes sense to me, Jarrett, that there's kind of three things. One is it's a small percent of the portfolio right now. So there's lots of upside for growth.
Yeah.
Two, it's sort of on trend in terms of the investors and ESG requirements and what consumers want as well. And then three, we actually have better technology nowadays to understand what's actually going to work. Whereas in the past, you might've had people sort of advocating for these kinds of products, but it felt a little bit too squishy or unscientific because we didn't really understand how it worked. Is that roughly?
Yeah, I would say exactly. I would say, yeah, it was in the past, it was maybe a little bit more outside the box, a little bit more, you know, kind of that more holistic approach. But I think with the science right now, it actually, a lot of it looks very good, but we just have to take that science and make it into a product.
One of the things that really strikes me here is, and maybe my assumption's wrong, but one of the ways that current agricultural input practices can get criticized is this sort of blanket approach, like it just kills everything, or, you know, it sort of has this. And so maybe you don't need to understand as much of that science. And I think it gets to your point before on like how much do growers really need to understand, because it isn't a silver bullet. You can't just do this. You also have to apply zinc, or you need to think about it in these conditions, but not in these conditions. So it really changes the kind of advice that they need and how they think about planning and how they think about different applications versus something that's maybe a bit more simple. Is that a challenge in the industry, or am I just oversimplifying how easy it is with traditional chemistry?
When I think about it, you have this, you kind of have all this complexity around it, of course, which to your point, it's more about how do we have an easy button. But what makes this also challenging is it's invisible in a lot of ways. When you apply a herbicide, you can see the weed die. You can see it turn purple. You can see it turn yellow. When you apply a fungicide, you can see the disease decreasing or not moving up any faster. You can see dead insects with an insecticide. When it comes to biostimulants, in a lot of ways, it is something that is entirely invisible. Sometimes you do get a nice greening response. Sometimes you do get less disease, those sorts of things. But a lot of the time, it's all internal. And so that can be a challenge to really get people to buy in and to see the benefit and those sorts of things. And even when you see that benefit, there's still this function of the incentive for the farmer. And right now, there's not necessarily incentive to apply less nitrogen and improve the nitrogen use efficiency. There's not necessarily the incentive to have better soil health, all these sorts of things. So a farmer views it as, well, I could just put on more nitrogen instead of applying this $10 an acre product, or I can just apply more phosphorus or something along those lines, right? And so you get this misalignment of incentives that is still a challenge for people to see. And until we get some of that figured out, I think that's one of the little hurdles, I suppose, when it comes to getting adoption, moving the needle even more. I think Jarrett alluded to it. Biostimulants and biologicals are supposed to grow at a CAGR of something like 13% year over year, somewhere in there. But if we could really get more agronomists, I mean, that's pretty rapid, but when you look at farmers and agronomists that have apprehension, that could be even higher if we had a better understanding of the incentives, had a better understanding of how they actually work.
It goes to your point before around what farmers actually need to know and how much information they can be provided with. But it's not just information, right? It's also the incentives and the practice change and the advice to actually get the value out of these products. And where does that value sit? Is it just a yield increase like they might be used to? Or is it thinking about nutrition or what consumers want or tying it to some kind of supply chain incentive? I guess there's a whole other set of challenges that I wanted to talk about briefly, which is like, does it require practice change? Like, how do you apply this? Do I need to treat something differently? Do I need to spray something differently? Do I need different equipment? Do I need to store it differently? Which is a range of challenges for kind of going to market with these products. So maybe, Jarrett, can you talk a little bit about the challenges with actually fitting into the current system?
And So first of all, you have to fit in. I mean, I've sat down, I guess, in the last year and a half, Zoomed with many companies and I kind of joke with them because they have this concept and they want to change the way a producer grows their crop. And so, you know, I'm usually fairly blunt with them and kind of say, well, you're not going to be successful. This has got nothing to do with your technology. This has got to do with you have to fit in with what they're doing, right? So you have to figure out how are you compatible with their planter or their air seeder. And the way you put on something through drip irrigation in California, you have to, you know, cut your mind off when you start coming to broadacre agriculture that doesn't have drip irrigation. So you have to basically integrate in. So what a lot of people are trying to do is they're saying, well, I want to get on the seed because it's fairly economical and we get a good response. Well, first of all, it is fairly economical and you do get a good response, but trying to get on the seed, everybody wants to get on the seed and there's only so much space on the seed. So that's a whole nother question. So now you say, well, if I don't own a seed company or if I don't have a strategic partnership with a seed company, how do I get on the seed? That's really hard. So now you say, okay, well, now I got to get into the existing application as a soil application. So my product is, and I'm just making these as examples, my product's a liquid fertilizer, but 94% of the farmers use granular fertilizer. So am I going to ask them to switch to a liquid? Well, you got 6% of the market you can go after. The other 94% said no. So you're going to say, well, maybe I'll get them to spray my biostimulant onto their granular fertilizer. Well, people don't have the equipment to do that. So again, you have a great technology, you can't get on. So you got, and then of course you have to be compatible. If it's an in-season spray, your timing has to match a herbicide timing. It has to have a fungicide timing, or maybe somebody's new plant growth regulators. They have a different timing. So that's actually opening things up, but you have to integrate in. It has to go right in what they're doing. And in a lot of these farms, a lot of these big farms nowadays, a lot of people talk about they're planting 7 to 10% of their entire farm in one day. 7 to 10%. It doesn't matter if you're a 1,500 acre farmer or in Shane's area, there's some 60 or 70,000 acre farmers. They're planting 7 to 10% of their farm in a day. So you have to fit into their system. It has to be flawless. And again, practicality, or some people refer to logistics, logistics trumps the technology sometimes. So this is where sometimes it's a give and a take. Maybe you take something, maybe not quite as perfect, but it fits in naturally. And I think people that are getting commercial understand that. We do still have a number. Wow. I talked to a lot of companies that have a great product, but they're the form of the product, the delivery of their product, the dustiness of their product, the lack of compatibility. It's their kiss of death.
It's fascinating because this doesn't apply just to biologicals, right? You can even go all the consumer side and say single-use plastics or something like that, right? Getting humans to change their behavior and bring a bag to the grocery store and use bins and fill them with jars. Like, we're just not going to do it. So it's much easier to make a plastic bag that we can just throw away better. But, you know, how environmentally friendly is that? And there's a million applications. So it gets actually back to human psychology, I would say, as much as any kind of particular technology.
Yeah. I'll throw one more comment in there. It's aligned with what you just alluded to, Sarah, and Jarrett talked about too, but this is more on the biopesticide side of things, but the need for other technology, not just the equipment and the logistics side of things, but if we get into pheromone-based biopesticides, all of a sudden, you're not going to just go and, you know, apply this random pheromone clear across to disrupt the mating cycles of insects. You need to understand where are the insects? What insects are there? And I know there's a company Tenacious invested in that can help remotely identify those insects, but that's a need for that type of technology. And then the, call it, large scale buy-in of numerous farms and groups clear across a large geography to be able to leverage the biopheromone, because insects move. They're not just this, they don't stop at field borders. They don't really care whether there's a field border there or a road or not, they're going to move. And so you need some of these other technologies to help support the adoption of some of these bio-based products.
Which I guess to me kind of leads to some of these business model challenges. And we've got new kinds of investors wanting to fund agriculture generally and biologicals in particular, venture capital investors among them, which I see there's a couple of challenges. One, just understanding the science and how complex it can be. Two is maybe all those trials you were talking about before, Jarrett, to really understand the mechanism, like that's expensive and may or may not be well suited to kind of venture capital timelines and, you know, funding, you know, CapEx requirements, that kind of things. And then the third one is the business model or the adoption. Like, is this something that just goes in a channel, gets crunched through margins over time? And ultimately, like, how do you get to scale and actually make the kind of return venture capital investors would be looking for?
Here's the thing that I'll try to capture in essence. For any of these companies to be a one product company, the probability of success is very low. And there's a lot of reasons. And I'll start with a few, and I'm pretty sure I got my whiteboard. I got all the lists. The first one is the cost to do this science, the cost to have an accountant, a production manager, a logistics person, a sales team, and so on, is very large, whether you have one product or a portfolio. So your cost of that business is very large with one product. The other thing is you can think about the customer. The customers right now, one of their challenges at the ag retail level and the retail level is everybody's inundating them with their single super product. And there's hundreds of companies walking through that door. And customers, retailers, distributors, and growers don't want to just have to focus so much time on one product. They want somebody with a portfolio. And what that ties into is the relevancy of every visit. My whole thing is that you got to be authentic, you got to be differentiated, and you got to be relevant. So what you talk to the producer, the retailer in January is different than what you talk to them in April, different than what you talk to them in June, different when we talk to them in July and August. You have to have what is relevant, what helps them fill a gap at that window that you're having that 30-minute call with them. So what happens is single product companies have a very difficult challenge. Yes, there's a product called Roundup. We may know about that. Kind of the biggest herbicide in the world, okay? That's the exception. But let's think about the biologicals. What's wrong with the biggest biologicals out there? And that's nitrogen-fixing organisms, right? Rhizobium, Brady rhizobium. And there's companies that have a portfolio around that and they do very well. But as we look at other companies that maybe have a bacillus or some type of Pseudomonas, for them to really get that into the market is hard. So they need to find a strategic partner to go to the market. And this is where consolidation, either at the company level or at the distributor level, is going to be key for the financial success of this company. And I mean, I've talked to distributors, retailers for the last 30 something years. They never question a company's product, but they go, I don't have that much time to spend with that company for one product that it's proven, but the farmers aren't running in to order it. Yes, there's a lot of demand creation, a lot of work, a lot of effort gone into it. And yes, they're saying there's lots of margin, but the revenue right now is very low.
I want to ask Shane, one of the challenges in this space as well is what fits into the system right now and what might be attractive to a retailer when he goes or an advisor to go have those visits and have something every season to talk about that's relevant might be really different than what a venture capital investor might sort of see as long-term successful. So there is this kind of near-term adds value today challenge, but fits in the existing system might require, you know, margin crunch, et cetera, versus kind of possible futures. How do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a good question. We've talked a little bit about that. Is the factor of the scalability of something and the defensibility of something. And part of that is you have something that might fit into the retail or the farmer's day-to-day right now with a 4 or 5 products that might be very stable. They might be very efficacious. They might have a very tank mixable approach as well. And so really nice fit right now. But all of a sudden, when you start to factor in a different future, or some of these other trends that are coming, like carbon sequestration. All of a sudden, how does that tie into what this product is going to do? Today, it's not necessarily relevant, but might be more interesting for a venture capitalist in the future, because all of a sudden, now can you come up with a unique business model that integrates into that carbon model or that carbon credit system that helps to support that farmer to produce better quality grains or outputs, as well as give them a new revenue stream or an incremental revenue stream from the carbon. So that's, and I think one of the other aspects of this too is the, call it defensibility, that we've talked about before. But when you have something that is 3% better, you know, Jarrett was talking about all these different products. Well, one product might be 3% better than everything else out there, but it's just going to turn into a terrible game to play. To it gets commoditized, everything gets crunched from a margin perspective, but then it also leads to weird, terrible games in the marketplace as well, with tricking of trials and all these different things. And so really what is probably going to be the most interesting to the venture capital groups is something that is going to fit into a bigger platform play. And again, what that exactly looks like gets to be kind of what we alluded to earlier with the pheromones and different technologies. What sort of technology is going to help with really understanding the carbon being sequestered, the amount being sequestered, to be able to verify that, and which biological is actually going to deliver that to the farmer and to that soil. And so this is where it starts to get a little more interesting, in my opinion, from that longer term perspective. But you start to have to use your imagination a little bit more than the traditional linear route to market that we would traditionally be talking about and considering today.
Which is actually different than how an agronomist might see it, right? If you're an agronomist today or a retailer thinking about procurement and partnerships, you may or may not be thinking about that longer term perspective, but the kinds of things you'd be recommending or thinking about procuring and distributing would be pretty different, I imagine. Is that true? Jarrett, you're nodding.
Yeah, you know, I think it is. I mean, we work with our innovative distributors and retailers and growers, and they see it. They really see how things connect up. And Shane nailed it. I don't want to sound like a broken record, but the carbon piece, you know, if you read the articles, it's a wild west. But at the end of the day, it is a really fascinating mechanism, because what it's really going to do is it's really going to help us get a better handle on where we sit. Where's our baseline at today? I mean, I think about broad acre agriculture. I think about 19% of the soils. Our soil sampled fields are sampled every year. 60% of the fields are sampled once every 3 years. 3 to 5% of the fields, sometimes 1 to 3% of the fields, are tissue sampled. So we're trying to be scientists. We have great technology, and we refuse to go to the doctor to see where we're at. I mean, how can you put on an investment, a significant investment of all these elements, if you don't have a soil test? How can we put on investment of managing a crop when we don't have a tissue test or a blood analysis to say how we're doing here today? So when I think about the carbon program, I think about, you're measuring organic carbon, which is organic matter. So in measuring that mechanism, the baseline, that field, you're probably going to start to measure other elements. So to me, the carbon platform is a fantastic platform to actually learn more about our soil health, our soil system, and ultimately our plant system, which comes into this restoring the balance. And this becomes this philosophical challenge of, do you restore the balance in the soil by creating a healthier plant that excretes metabolites into the root rhizosphere that the biological population of the soil says, thank you, and I'm going to proliferate, making the soil more healthy? Or is it the reverse? My background is soil chemistry. The last 20 years has been plant nutrition. So I'm more on the plant nutrition side right now. But again, it is this complicated system. I think the carbon platform is totally cool. I think we're going to learn a ton about everything because of this. And again, hopefully people get rewarded for it. And if you don't do it, I don't want it to be, if you don't do it, you get penalized. And that's my concern with some of these government programs. If you don't fill in your survey, we're going to charge you more money. If you fill it in, we'll get you back where you are. That platform never has ever gone over well. To me, there has to be an incentive.
Yeah, just speaking to the agronomy side of the equation, Sarah, you alluded to, when I think of what an agronomist's role is, it's to maximize profitability, taking into account sustainability, optimizing for sustainability and production. And so when you start to layer in other products or other revenue streams, you just need to take that into the equation. And today, carbon's not necessarily in the equation, but all of a sudden, when you start to add a different revenue stream into that equation, or you start to have the sustainability function of that weighted heavier, all of a sudden, that's just something that's going to need to be considered in within the context of a recommendation, within planning, and within the conversations with farmers. And I think given that, we will see biologicals begin to, you know, work their way in a little bit more within that sort of conversation.
The other aspect, I guess, if we're talking about incentives and kind of platforms, carbon's one sort of efficacy in the field and things farmers already care about is another. The thing that is interesting about carbon is consumers are starting to care. And so you get these other big machines in the system moving in this direction. I guess another one that strikes me that could be possible is nutrition. If we start to understand more the relationship between what's happening at an agronomic level and nutrition, that there's maybe some pull through from brands and consumers. Is that possible or another kind of platform that could drive adoption?
I think that's an interesting one. The answer is, I would say, is yes. We just have a little bit of a ways to go on that. And again, I'll come back to my Harvest Zinc initiative. We've done a lot of work. Many people have done a lot of work to show how to make nutrient-dense food. And it's by intensively managing your crop, using analytical tools to know where you're at and knowing when to put on certain nutrients to increase the density in that harvested crop. Wouldn't it be cool to go to a store and be able to determine the nutrient density of that tomato or of that bunch of grapes or of that banana and actually knowing what the nutrient density is so that we're not consuming just biomass in our body, we're actually consuming the elements that we need. And I think driving to nutrient density is, sadly for myself, Sarah, that's actually already, I'm almost exhausted through that because and Shane was a part of this when we first got going on this. I think maybe we were a little bit ahead of our time, or maybe we were a little too optimistic in that people will just jump on it. And I really think as we move from the mechanism of farming, whether it's be conventional farming or organic farming or regenerative farming or all the different types of farming, ultimately the consumer wants, I think, is a good return to their body for every kilogram of food they consume.
Yeah, exactly. I would totally agree. And the potential for these kinds of solutions to deliver more of those benefits, more of the consumer benefits, seems like a no-brainer. And yet, as we've been talking about the complexity around how you actually do that, who pays for it, how you get to scale, how you know that it works, and how you avoid the kind of snake oil sales question is the real one. I know when I was first looking at this space, I started calling them sort of magical plant whispering juices because that's how it felt. You know, you meet the kind of crazy scientist in the lab that's like, well, if you just make this concoction and then it, you know, look at our trial results here. And we also did it in this country and look at it over on this plant and it's magical. But you get into how would you scale that? How do you repeat it? How is it shelf stable? Like, these are not easy questions to answer. I guess I want to end on, when you zoom out and look forward, call it 10, 15 years, do you think we're having really different conversations? Are these widely adopted? There's consolidation in the industry. I'll start with you, Shane.
Yeah, I think what we will see is that there will be increased adoption and utilization of these biostimulant-based or bio-based products. And I don't think it's necessarily going to be all standalone or this or that, or it's going to be more of this and that. And so we will see more combo formulations where there's going to be a biopesticide co-formulated with a synthetic pesticide. And that's really a big opportunity because there's millions and millions of kilograms of synthetic pesticides put down. But the biggest opportunity is not to just cold turkey cut them out and use these biopesticides. It's to strategically integrate the bio-based products where it makes sense to make sure that they are augmenting that synthetic product. And I think there's opportunity in that. So I think that's something that we will see in the next 10 years. I think when it comes to being able to essentially start to code the DNA and be able to make or genetically engineer a microbe to produce exactly or close to exactly what you want, which will really increase not only the stability, but the efficacy and the consistency of that biostimulant or that bio-based product in the soil or in the plant or in combination with a synthetic product. So I think that technology is really going to underpin a lot of what we see in the next 10, 15 years. So that's something I'm bullish on and excited for to help move things ahead in this space.
I shouldn't have let Shane go first. So much for the young people respecting their elders. I think Shane nailed it. It's about integration of these technologies to slowly evolve the space to the reduction in some other inputs. One of the things I think that's also interesting that Shane alluded to was the industry, we're not using biologicals to their fullest, like say we would in maybe the pharmaceutical industry or some of these other industries. Like if we think about it, MSG, you can make MSGs through the fermentation using a certain organism. I mean, of course, we use fermentation to make cheese and milk and lactic acid and citric acid. So if you start thinking about that and you start thinking about where do I see a biologicals fitting? I see biologicals fitting as a production plant sitting in some company's facility that the organisms are your engine, rather than having compressors and heat and pressure and extracting nitrogen from the atmosphere or taking some type of compound and pulling it together. We're going to ask, I think we should be asking the organisms to make this end product, just like they do in the pharmaceutical industry. Then we extract that compound, and that compound, as Shane alluded to, may look very similar to a synthetic chemical, but it's not made through chemical synthesis. It's made through biological synthesis. And if we can say that this organism, and I don't even want to say one, but you just, because I don't know, by the way, you just have some organism, some bacillus species that makes a compound that looks very much like a compound for weed control or fungal control. I think that is where, if this can happen, it can move. And I think it can move because it's moved in almost every other industry we're in, whether it's the food industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the clothing industry. We're using organisms to develop compounds. So where we're at right now, we got organisms we want to put on into the soil. Shane and I talk about this a lot. Are the organisms even alive or dead when they go into the soil? People say, but they still work. Well, good. So why are they working? Is it the organism or is it the compound they produce? So it's probably the compound they produce. Now, if we take those 1,000 compounds that they make and we start to slipstream it down, and Shane was referring to it earlier about using great analytical chemistry to isolate this one compound that now controls nematodes. And I'm just picking, I don't know why I said nematodes, fixes nematodes that looks very similar to a synthetic chemical. Is that not what we want as an entire society? And we use organisms as a positive production plant. And then ultimately that's going to reduce our carbon emissions too.
And that's it for another episode of AgTech So What. Thank you for listening. And thank you to our guests, Jarrett Chambers from ATP Nutrition and Shane Thomas from Upstream Ag Insights. We're going to continue to dig into biologicals in the future, so stay tuned and reach out if you have any questions you want answered or examples to share. What experiences have you had with biologicals? We always love to hear your feedback. For more resources from this episode, please visit our website, agtechsowhat.com, and follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. I'm Sarah Nillette. Catch you next time.